Nikki, I wanted to talk a little bit about spirits.
Not whiskey.
No. Not on this occasion. So I wanted to talk about explore a little bit the idea of how spirits exist and what we mean when we use the word spirit and what we're sort of pointing to with that word.
Mm.
And obviously it's a word that has lots of different sort of positions within culture. If we think of just the expressions within English where we use the word spirit, like talking about alcoholic spirits, through to talking about the spirits of the age or the spirit of a nation, or the idea of an individual spirit, perhaps a ghost, for example, or an elemental entity.
Mm-hmm.
So the one word kind of describes a lot of things that in some senses seem to be quite different.
Mm.
I wonder whether or not there's any linking kind of connection between those and what that might be.
I would say it's sort of the essence, the distillation of the character of something is how I would sort of summarise those different ways that spirit is used. So the spirit of a place, the genius loci, which is a thing that probably a lot of people are familiar with and has been around for a long time. It's a Roman concept. So the spirit of a place or the fairy of a place or whatever, that's the character of the place, but it's distilled down into an actual figure, which might not be something you can actually see. That's the interesting things about spirits, is that they tend to be quite nebulous and they can actually be invisible, but you can still very much sort of sense them in a way.
I did. That's quite interesting, isn't it? Because when we talk about the sort of the idea of the character of something, and particularly from a sort of a perspective informed by the ideas of chaos magic, it's also about like an activity. So a spirit is like an activity; it's a doing, in the same way that a personality is a process, isn't it? Rather than a fixed thing.
Yes. Yeah. It's to do with the. It's not just the place as a static thing, it's how it affects people when they're there. So the spirit of a place, going back to the same example, the spirit of a place is about whether you feel in particularly different when you get there. So it feels like you've met something and encountered something, which could be why it has that sense of an otherness, which then you locate within this persona, which is then the spirit.
And there's that idea, isn't there, as well, about the way that our neurology is geared up to deal with human entities, with personalities. And so it's unsurprising that when we meet, for example, a particularly significant place, we conceptualise that back to ourselves, or we may choose to do so as an entity which is similar in some sense to a human. It has a personality or it has a face even.
Mm. Yeah, so as sort of if you look at it from a biological, evolutionary, kind of sociological perspective, then that all makes sense in that kind of language. But it's very interesting how different people perceive the spirit of either a place or an occasion or whatever it is that we're talking about. And they tend to perceive it in very similar ways, which does give it a kind of, not exactly material reality, but it gives it an objective sense of something that exists outside of those that perceive it, which I find very fascinating.
Okay. That's interesting. I guess one of the things that comes up as a bit of a perennial discussion is this idea of the reality of spirits. And I often find some of those conversations, for me, kind of miss the mark a little bit, in the sense that we can describe the spirit of, let's just take a human. Let's just imagine a human has a spirit, that there is, that's a meaningful statement. But we can describe the human, obviously, in terms of a series of chemical interactions or a series of sociological constructs or a series of linguistic acts or whatever. And so when we talk about the reality or otherwise of a spirit, I think that a lot of that depends on the frame of reference that we use to talk about it and to discuss it. And that it's not a sort of an either or. It's not the case that humans are just a collection of chemical impulses and interactions, neither yet are they purely social beings. They're a a thing that can be described in lots and lots of different ways without making one more or less real or more or less valuable than another.
Yeah, definitely. That's something that sometimes is difficult when you're having conversations about this, and then you explain it in the way that we were just talking about, to do with the sort of the way that humans like to conceptualize things as anthropomorphizations of whatever it is they're looking at. And the fact that that's one way of looking at it doesn't exclude or preclude the way that of talking about it as a real spirit that has real kind of life to it. It's just another way of looking at those things. To me, that doesn't reduce that to merely those types of like scientific, rational ways of explaining it. It just allows us to accept those things. So for me, it actually adds to the reality of a spirit to have that as a pathway to conceive of it.
I mean, I often think of spirits in terms of the magical work that I do, where we're looking at the spirit, which is anything from a kind of demonic classic kind of goetic entity through to something which is perhaps the spirit of a certain type of social interaction. So for example, capitalism as a thing that we might have some sort of magical interaction with, and that it's a kind of a systems approach, so that the spirit isn't located particularly in one element of that any more than one might locate the spirit purely in one description of, say, a human. So for example, if you wanted to, in my view, change a political process, then the idea that the spirit that you're working with is somehow located in an individual person who happens, for example, to be the president, is sort of missing the point, because it's the structure that creates an office called the president, and the kinds of social interactions and meanings and notions around that that constitute the spirit that you might be working with in order to affect some sort of, you know, social or cultural change. Or equally, within an individual, we might conceptualize a spirit as being a personality that we're working with, like a sub-personality or an entity that we're kind of conjuring with. But the spirit itself is a series of interactions, including between the magician and the perceived entity or aspect of the self. That is the spirit. The spirit isn't the mask that the spirit appears to wear. It's the cybernetic process.
Yeah, we were talking earlier today about how countries have like personalities. So you've got sort of nested kind of layers and overlapping Venn diagrams of spirit as well. So as well as the spirit of a particular political movement, if I was trying to affect that kind of thing, I'd also look at the other types of spirit that are involved, which are the spirit of the country, the spirit of all sorts of other things, and the interactions between them. And seeing those in that sort of social thing as different personas, which massively oversimplifies it, but then that allows the processing to see how those things relate to each other, affect each other, and can then be affected by an individual personality of the magician. But that sounds a bit kind of ordinary, so talking about them in terms of spirit is much more exciting, and it also allows for things to exist within that conversation which can't do if you're just conceiving it as just strictly a personality. So there's great value in using that kind of thing, and it's much more magical, much more exciting. And to be honest, it's a big part of being a magician is to make the world more exciting and to know that you can influence it in ways that you don't necessarily understand as well.
And I think that process that you've described there of again giving faces to things in order to make it easier to interact with them and more creative, more interesting, richer in some respects, because that allows us to then get feedback from the spirit. If we're deciding that we want to interact with a thing as though it's a conscious autonomous entity, then we're going to be able to have a conversation with it in the same way that, you know, you might have a conversation with the recalcitrant car or photocopier in your office. And as I think Ramsay Jukes points out in one of his books, that's actually really quite an intelligent way of approaching things in many respects, even down to the level of our physics, where we talk about photons deciding to go through one slit or the other.
Yeah, it's nearly impossible to not do that, isn't it, in ordinary life? And certainly the people that I know that have good relations with their computers tend to work a lot better than the people that swear and shout at them all the time.
So I think that really, in terms of, you know, if we're talking about the process of being a magician and using spirits, interacting with spirits, we're talking about exactly that process. It's something which is a magical view of the universe, which is sometimes, perhaps for many people, particularly maybe in the kind of industrialized world, you know, outside of what they would normally be expected to do. This isn't something that we're taught to do as a, you know, as a useful way of engaging with the world. We're used to the idea of there are objective things out there in the universe, and while that description is sometimes useful, the notion of imbuing things with spirits and interacting with spirits, whether they, you know, gods, angels, demons, aspects of ourselves, interact complex social interactions, then that's exactly what a magician is in the business of doing.
Mm. And a lot of children view the world in that kind of way as well. So it's very easy to explain the world to children in that kind of semi-magical, is that the right kind of word? Magical kind of way, where instead of things just being inanimate objects, then they actually sort of, you treat them as, or not even objects, but actually sort of occasions. Like, I know that you sort of talk about Father Christmas sometimes when we sort of think about the spirit,
yeah,
kind of model.
Yeah,
and I mean, how that's a very real thing. Christmas would not happen without Father Christmas.
Exactly. So my conversation with my oldest son went something along the lines of, you know, there was a point at which he said, well, there isn't really such a thing as, you know, Father Christmas. And I said, well, you know, obviously there is not a man who flies through the sky on a sled pulled by reindeer.
That would be silly.
And he said, yeah, of course that would be silly. I said, but what Father Christmas is Father Christmas is the spirit of giving gifts at midwinter. And in order for us to say the spirit of giving gifts at midwinter and to summarise it and to kind of interact with it and to be creative and playful with it, we give it a face, we give it a name, we give it a means of transportation through the air.
Yep.
And, you know, I kind of said to him, well, you know, now you're old enough that you can actually give gifts to other people because you can make them or even buy them yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And that means you become Father Christmas and you know what that means. You become this spirit, you become an aspect of this spirit. And we have a really clear picture of that, and that's really helpful to us in terms of conceptualising what's going on.
Yeah, it's a very useful shorthand in that kind of way. But I actually believe in Father Christmas to the extent that I tend to, as it's sort of like in the run-up to Christmas, I'm like, right, so I'm going to get a present from Father Christmas. This is how my personal view of it goes. And so I look out just with a little bit of extra perception of spotting things that I might want that are on either sale or find in charity shops, things I'm sort of on the lookout for. And then if I see something that's perfect for either myself or a member of my family or a friend, then I'll buy that and I'll wrap it up for them and I'll sign it Father Christmas. Lots of love.
So you know, as a magician, you're embodying that spirit.
I'm channeling Father Christmas.
Exactly.
And he's working through me.
And
that's because I believe in Father Christmas very, very much.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I wonder in terms of when we engage with those sorts of discussions about spirits. I mean, the sense I think that some people feel, particularly people who maybe come from traditions where there's at least a perception that the view of spirits is far more what we might describe as objective. So whether that's a spiritualist or spiritist kind of view, whether it's some of the Western conceptualizations of African traditional religions or traditional witchcraft or whatever, I think that one of the mistakes, that as I see it, is this notion that to view spirits in other ways erodes and undermines somehow the reality of that experience.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not the case for me. I think it kind of enriches it in the same way that it enriches me to have lots of descriptions of what a human is or what a tree is or whatever, and doesn't actually, particularly given your example, preclude a genuine, heartfelt, meaningful interaction with, in this case, the spirit of Father Christmas.
Yes. It's difficult for me because when I hear people talk about spirits in that very objective, they're from sort of like a parallel dimension kind of another material reality kind of way. It kind of annoys me, but I'm also a bit jealous of it as well, because sometimes I wish that I could step into it quite so fully, but then sometimes I realise that I actually do. So it's just that I don't permanently hold on to that view.
I think that's one of the things, isn't it? Which is that, again, it's a question of individual styles, and it's a question of individual emphasis at different points in one's magical life. Because I remember doing work with the Holy Guardian Angel, and part of the practice for me of engaging with that spirit was exploring the idea that this spirit was that which was not me. So by the very nature of that statement, I had to explore this thing as though it were a completely separate objective entity.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, people are really, really fascinated by that. I mean, that's part of the whole thing with the vogue for taking ayahuasca or DMT and trying to find, trying to check out Terence McKenna's machine elves, is this desire for this kind of external objective entity that we can, at least at a conceptual level, point to and say, look, this isn't just my head going all mad. This is a real thing kind of out there in the world.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's not surprising, really, that people that are drawn to the occult, who are looking for something more than the world that they're sort of like rationally explained to them, are going to go for that kind of thing because that's what they're seeking for. So, and it's I'm sure that you as well have had different experiences where it's been very difficult to explain it unless you can think of spirits as being something that have separate identities of their own and their own volition and their own ability to affect the world, which is nothing to do with us at all. And that's a really quite a thrilling thing when it happens, but it's also important, I think, not to get too caught up in it, because otherwise you end up being in too much in awe of the spirit, which to me seems a bit strange, because I like to have relations with things rather than just sort of get instructions from them, which is something which can happen if you be a little bit too much in that sort of, they're a real thing that has real power.
I guess
I'm not quite sure exactly what I'm trying to say.
No, right? I understand that. I think for me, yes, there are occasions with the magic I've done where the easiest way of explaining it is that I met a spirit and we had this interaction and the following things took place, and this is, that was the story. So there are certainly things I can point to like that. I guess one of the things that I quite like is the kind of Jungian psychological view, which kind of posits this notion that there is our, waking, everyday, objective, conscious self, such as it is, or such as it appears to be, retrospectively put
that's,
together.
That's another
story. But the thing that actually drives most of what happens are archetypal processes, archetypal entities. And there's a lovely description of that Jung gives of an archetype being the psychological expression of a physiological fact. So the existence of the mother, the existence of the child, the existence of the wise old figure in terms of that archetypal pantheon, and that it's those are the things that really run just our psyches, let alone any kind of other dimensions or other worlds or things at different vibrational frequencies or whatever. This stuff is the stuff that really drives us. And so it's hardly surprising that the little island of apparent self-aware identity consciousness occasionally looks up from what's going on and goes, oh, blimey, that spirit actually did something and it was nothing to do with me. And that I reckon happens quite a lot. And so having that as a description allows me to also create a sense in which it's not an on or an off. It's not a these things exist in parallel or alternate dimensions and I'm able to interact with them in the dimension in which I inhabit. It's that there is a field that exists that includes material objects, that includes psychological processes, that includes social processes, and includes things that emerge as awareful, conscious, intelligent, autonomous entities out of that matrix, one of which is me, mm-hmm. another one of which is you, mm-hmm. another one which is those spirit entities, which it's harder to point to, but nevertheless we can see their effects.
Yes. Joseph Campbell's series of books, The Masks of God, talks about that kind of thing, the way that the sort of the relationships between family members and things like that become archetypes. Have you read that?
Yes.
And that for me is very accessible because it's not a psychological thing, it's just a comparative mythology kind of angle that he's taking on it. And he looks at all different stories and gives really good examples from all different places and times throughout the globe. And I found that when I read that many, many years ago, incredibly fascinating. And it really explained archetype types much better to me than the way that Jung did, because it was from stories, which is something that really, you know, presses my buttons. So those sort of processes which are much more eternal than the temporary flesh that we inhabit, they seem to have this definite separate thing going on for them, which we can just sort of talk to, but it's definitely beyond the individual. So it's not part of our psyche. That's a really sort of the wrong way round of looking at it. We're more part of its manifestation.
Yeah. That's probably a nice way of conceptualizing it, that rather than us being these islands of awareness kind of looking out on the vista of all these kind of spirits which wink in and out of existence, it's actually more that there's a network or a matrix of spirits, some of which we describe as molecular processes, and some of which we describe as archetypal entities, and some of which we might describe as gods or demons or whatever, mm-hmm. and that network gives rise to our own individual consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been reading a bit recently about the way that spirits of people and the way that sort of reincarnation or I was reading Serena Rooney Dougal's book, The Fairy Faith, at the moment, and I'm partway through it, and there's an interesting bit about how changelings were sometimes viewed as having their souls replaced by the fairies with either a fairy soul spirit or with the spirit of one of the ancestors of the child, and that's why they have this sort of like almost like an old person's knowledge when they're young. And even today, a lot of people will still sort of like look at a child and go, oh, they're an old soul. It happened with my daughters. And so that kind of thing of a spirit and a personality existing and then reappearing in another person, that's something that we've all encountered in different kind of casual ways, not necessarily in a sort of separate box that you would label magic. But a lot of magic for me is the sort of thing that happens in that kind of way, where it isn't something that you would expressly label magic. It's something that is part of my particular path, is the way that magic is a very intrinsic part of mundane reality. It's just that we don't label it as that such all the time, and so it goes just sort of seamlessly happens.
Yeah, and I think that's where, again, a sort of a magician sensibility, if you like, is something that's really interesting. There's a lovely description, going back to Carl Jung, of him coming back to the house that he sort of, you know, built and had built, and having been away for a long time, and greeting all the pots and pans and saying, "Oh, pots and pans, I'm really sorry, I've been away for a long time," and you know, whoever the person was who was recording this particular incident being sort of mildly amused by this, mm-hmm. but that being a genuine way of interacting with the world, and a way that's useful, and a way that has all kinds of benefits, if you like.
Definitely. I always do that when I leave or sort of arrive at a particular dwelling. So I always go, "Hello, house," or "Goodbye, house, I'll be back in so much time, look after yourself while I'm gone." And as well as having that sort of interaction with the spirit of the house on a practical level, that pays off because it gives you sort of a different type of awareness. So if I'm leaving the house and I'm saying goodbye to it, I know I'm going to be gone for a long time, and so I'm sort of like extra going through a checklist in my head of have I turned everything off that I should have done, have I locked things, have I closed the windows, which is because I'm giving that attention and that emotional care and love to that place. So that's the sort of the physical, practical benefit that you get from doing that, but it also makes me feel like I'm not just walking out on it. And because obviously your house is something that has a huge amount of attachment to you, or you have to it rather, so it's important to relate to it in that kind of way for me, and I can't imagine not doing that. And certainly when I move houses, when I leave, I sort of look around and I go around every single room and sort of say goodbye to it, because otherwise I would feel like I hadn't achieved closure, to use that kind of slightly sort of cynical term, but that's a real genuine thing that happens. So
maybe we can say that in a way the meaning or the existence of a spirit is the relationship that you have with it. So it is about that that process of going into relationship with, you know, whatever the thing is that you want to enter the relationship with, whether it's a building or whether it's a place or whether it's a particular goetic entity or god or goddess or what have you.
Yeah, and that gives it a reality which is more than a physical reality.
It's true.
Mm.